on the early childhood issue. We had a number of people that wanted to testify, and so I will ask people to keep their comments brief to be able to accommodate as many as we can. But extended support revenue, welcome, Commissioner. And I know there's a couple of topic areas in here, but I know specifically some of us have received some communication with some concerns about language in the extended support, and I know in speaking with your staff, maybe you are working on some language, so with regards to use of that during the school day and that. So if you wanted to comment on that, we would welcome any discussion or thoughts you'd like to offer us.
Yep. Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members, thank you so much for allowing me to speak to this topic. As many of you know, I have a 25-year experience working with middle and high schools, and with my work in Minneapolis schools as well, as both a high school assistant principal and an associate superintendent responsible for middle and high schools and overseeing alternative programs and contract alternatives in the district. So I've had a lot of experience with alternative education on both the district side and also in supervising and overseeing the contract alternatives within Minneapolis Public Schools. And it's been extremely important topic for me in order to get it right, because many of the students who are attending our alternative schools are students who are behind in credits or needing catch-up or needing help, and these are the students who are caught in our achievement gap. And so it's really imperative that when we do spend the kind of money that we do spend on alternative services, that there's the flexibility needed for school districts, that there's the access for students to be able to get the services, and that the services are rigorous enough in order for them to achieve and have good outcomes. So I just wanted to briefly go through a few things so that you could understand the context of my proposal and my recommendations. In 2013-14, there were 599 sites, including 264 area learning centers and 41 alternative learning programs, 13 contract alternative schools, and 281 targeted services programs. Currently, we spend about $132 million, where 10% goes to the district and about 90% goes directly to those programs that generated the funding. In 2010, the office, you should have in front of you some documents. In 2010, and I remember reading this when I was associate superintendent, the legislative auditor did a report on alternative learning programs, and it had several recommendations. And I recently reviewed that report prior to session starting and noticed that there were some things within the agency that we had gone beyond policy on, and I wanted to be able to correct that so that there was that we could clarify it for our alternative learning centers, for our school districts, and how they could participate in this program. So that's why I've made the recommendations in front of you. So the biggest one was that the legislative auditor found that targeted services showed higher expected growth with students in the elementary grades. And so I made some recommendations around that. Also, with the alternative learning programs, school districts were not allowed to participate in that program per MDE policy unless you had an ALC. And I think as we've set the targets for school districts to close achievement gaps by 50% by 2017, they need every tool in their toolkit in order to do that and in order to support our teachers and our students. And so you'll see in my recommendations in the policy in front of you that I am recommending that we give some flexibility to school districts in order to include the alternative learning programs and contract alternative schools. In the summary report of the Office of the Legislative Auditor, you'll see that it said that MDE should initiate a pilot project to use and evaluate additional measures of alternative education student performance. As you know, the High School of Recording Arts has come for several years talking about our accountability system and the way that we measure alternative learning programs. Currently, we have 26 schools that have less than a 60% graduation rate. We have been working with them to look at what are the measures that would be appropriate for accountability for them, and how can we better measure our schools, especially our alternative schools, around graduation rates. We can extend that work, and I'll make recommendations later about extending that work and working with our alternative school partners and alternative programs and school districts. Also, what you will see in the Office of the Legislator's key recommendations, the Minnesota legislator should allow all school districts to offer targeted services regardless of whether they provide alternative education programs. So I wanted to present a few pieces of data for you, and you should have those in your packet, and there's two per page, really quickly. When part of my job is looking at data and recommending policy changes so that we can improve the outcomes of our students. And I'm kind of known as a data geek. I remember the first day I walked into MDE and I wanted to see third grade reading scores, and I couldn't get them in one place. IT had some of it, assessment had some of it, finance had some of it, but nobody had it all in one place. Since then, we've created a data team so that when we ask these deeper questions about why is our graduation rate not at 90%, why do we see these disparities in our graduation rate, we have a data analytic team that can provide the information to us. And so that is of a service to you as well. So I wanted to present to you some of the cohort data for our 2013 class, because I could have presented 2014, but I didn't have the time to get it prepared. These were the questions I started asking about last year. How is everything contributing to our graduation rate as we started to look at our waiver and set our targets for a 90% graduation rate with no student group being below 85%? So if you look at the first slide, you will see our statewide cohort. This is overall, we have 67,000 students approximately in our graduating class. About 1,500 are American Indian students at 2%. 4,000 are Asian students at about 6%. 6,000 are our Black students at about 9%. 3,900 are Hispanic students at about 5.9%, and we have 51,000 white students at about 75%. If you go to the next slide, you can see our participation in our ALCs. What you see there is that even though our student body makes up about 25% students of color, our cohort of ALCs make up about 55% students of color. So we asked ourselves, why do we think this is? And how is this contributing to our achievement gap? I think because we have ALCs, and this is based on my own opinion, and I have no real concrete evidence of this, but high school principals know that they will not have their four-year graduation rate dinged if that student enrolls at an ALC. So this is a significant problem when you have schools, high schools, being able to refer students to an ALC maybe before they've actually been able to intervene with them. Why would they do that? Because school districts can't provide the services and aren't funded for that because of the recommendation that I'm making to fix here, where school districts would be allowed to be able to have the flexibility to use alternative learning programs rather than them having to be part of a consortia or a cooperative or an ALC. So I think if we give school districts and high schools the funding and the flexibility to intervene, maybe they wouldn't refer to ALCs as regularly as they are now, and we might not have this disproportionality. And I want to also say, as I say that, we do have successful ALCs, and we did provide in 1987 ALCs so that students had a choice of a different learning environment where it's successful. And so we want to be sure that where there's rigorous programming, where they're successful, where there are good outcomes, students do have the opportunities to go to an ALC rather than their high school. Then I wanted to have you go to the next slide and show that disproportionality. So even though we have 2% of American Indian students, 23% of our American Indian students in 12th grade are enrolled in an ALC. Even though we have 9% Black students, 20% are enrolled in ALCs that are 12th graders. And our Hispanic students, 6%, and you have 21% of our Hispanic students enrolled in ALCs in graduating class. So when we look at our graduating class, we ask ourselves, how many of them are in ALCs? So how are they doing with the graduating then? So if you look at the four-year cohort graduation rates by ethnicity for ALCs, not ALCs, and statewide, in the next slide, you will see that the graduation rate in ALCs is 14.9%, and in the state it's 48%. And then if we take out the ALCs in the state average, they would be 58%. For black students, it's even more alarming. 21% of black students are graduating in ALCs, while 57%, remember these are 2013 graduation rates, the graduation rate for black students is over 60% now, but last year it was 56.98%. If we took out the black students in the state average that are attending ALCs, the black average would be 66%. The ALC graduation rate for 4, 5, and 6 year, you might say, well, these are kids who are behind, so they need an additional year. You would expect that they wouldn't be graduating in a four-year cohort. So if you look at the four-year rate and the five-year rate and the six-year rate, you will see that there's not that big of a difference in the graduation rate. There's about a 10 to maybe 13, 14% difference in the graduation rate, but still well below 45% for all the student groups in graduation rate. What I thought was even really unique was if you look at the year 5 to 6, there's only a 1 or 2% difference in the graduation rate from the 5th year to the 6th year. So a question we might ask ourselves is, when we're doing investing in ALCs, should we be investing in ALCs for that 1 year beyond high school, but maybe not more years beyond high school? And are there different strategies? Finally, I wanted to point out the comparison of ALCs, not ALCs, and statewide four-year cohort rate by those that are continuing, and I want to specifically on this slide focus on dropout rate. What you notice is that in ALCs we have a 22% dropout rate. Again, you would expect that you would have a higher dropout rate, but I wanted you to see that the state average and that graduate at 80% at 79.48 and 84.64% is 5% difference approximately between the state average of graduation and the non-ALC graduation rate and what it would be if you pulled those ALC students out. Would we have such a high dropout rate if high schools had the flexibility to design programs and provide support to students and right there. And then students that want to have an ALC option, have those highly successful ALCs meet the needs of those students. I'm going to skip the next slide, which is just showing free and reduced price lunch, special ed and LEP, and you can see the big differences there as well. I'll just close with saying the recommendations that I'm making are, one, change the name from extended time to extended support. And the reason I do that is because some kids just can't come after school. Some kids are watching their siblings, or they hold another job, or they have athletic programs, which we know connectedness programs are beneficial to students who are behind, and getting them connected to athletics or arts or theater programming is really important. A lot of that work happens after school. So allowing school districts to be able to give support during the school day and during the school year would be good. Clarifies the law from 2010 of the OLA report to expand extended time revenue to ALPs and contract alternative schools. It allows school districts the use of extended time revenue for ALPs, and it eliminates the requirement that only ALCs can have an ALP, alternative learning program. It allows local school districts the flexibility to use extended time revenue during the school day for extended support. It creates a commissioner. It doesn't create a commissioner's, but I'm saying I would create a commissioner's working group because we have an evaluation that we have ready for you June of 15 that you asked us to do. And that will be ready June of 15. And what I'm suggesting is that we create an evaluation group to go over the evaluation findings, bring recommendations to this body for reforming our alternative ed programming and accountability and measurements to include looking at funding. Because when we looked at those schools that were 60% graduation rate or less, the funding was all over the place, very inequitable. So some of these kids who come to these ALCs with less get less funding as well. And I think we need to look at that so that in the future, these recommendations could bring not only how do we support schools better, give local districts the flexibility they need, but also have the adequate funding that they need in order for them to be really successful with kids. And then just finally, this is not in my recommendations, but it's a very important point that I know that the superintendent, Sandy Lewandowski of 287, has shared with this committee is about transportation. So school districts are not currently required to transport their students to ALCs outside of the district. This is particularly very problematic for students who would choose an ALC outside their district, and I would ask the committee to look at that provision. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any questions for the Commissioner on her presentation or this topic? Thank you. We very much appreciate your very thorough analysis and presentation on that topic. Thank you. All right. I also had testifiers from representatives from the charter schools, if they'd like to come forward, Eugene Piccolo and Brian Sweeney. And members, this is as it relates to an initiative in the House bill which would extend a portion of extended support revenue to charter schools. As you know, they don't currently are not eligible for that, and our proposal was to take 25% of the statewide average and allow charter schools to have that stream of revenue as well. So, gentlemen, whoever would like to start, please go ahead and introduce yourselves for the record.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Eugene Piccolo, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools. Thank you for the opportunity to share a few thoughts about the extended support revenue that the House is proposing for charter schools. Today, there are 47,700 charter school students in the state of Minnesota. Roughly a little over 5% of all public school students attend charter schools. If we were one district, we would be the largest district in the state of Minnesota. I wanted to share with you just a little information about who these students are. 55% of all charter school students qualify for free and reduced lunch, compared to 38% of the statewide average for all public school students. 19% of our students, or one out of five, are LEP or ELL students, compared to the state average of 8%. 53% of our students are minority students, compared to 30% statewide. I share this information with you only to bring to the attention that charter schools are serving significant populations of students who are considered oftentimes at risk, and many of whom need extended support. And so we ask for your support for extended time revenue, but we do question why a student would be worth only 25% if they attend a charter school compared to if they attend a traditional district. They are the same students, the same needs, and charter schools can do a good job in helping those students if they have adequate resources, as the commissioner pointed out. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, conference members, my name is Brian Sweeney, and I'm with Charter School Partners. We are a charter support group here in the Twin Cities. I'd just like to add on to Mr. Piccolo's comments with 2 points. Charter School Partners, a couple months ago, commissioned Clifton Larson Allen to do a disparity or a funding report between district and charter schools. And it found that in Minneapolis, the differentiation was 31%, St. Paul was 24%, and outside of the Twin Cities, it was 8.2%. In other words, districts were spending that much more per school or per pupil than in the charter sector. And we appreciate the extended time revenue proposal because that would help cut that gap. So we greatly appreciate that. The other point I'd like to make is we've heard testify in front of the education committees those schools that are closing the gap, that are closing the opportunity gap, the many gaps, and almost to a school, many of those were charter schools. And I just want to point out that some of those charter schools, for instance, Hiawatha Academy, have 1,565 hours per year of classroom work. Best Academy, part of the Harvest network of schools, have 1,345 hours per year. That's compared to the average of all charters, which actually is 1,090, and for Minneapolis Public Schools, 1,023, and St. Paul Public Schools, 1,008. So what's part of the secret sauce of closing the many gaps? It just may be that more time is spent on task. So this would acknowledge that the extended time revenue would acknowledge that, and I share Mr. Piccolo's concern that 25% is better than nothing, but charter school students are 100% as well. So there are two charter school leaders that are here, if it's all right to hear them. So,
very briefly, that would be fine. Yeah. Thank you. Welcome. If you please state your name for the record.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Dr. Detrika Chukwu, and I'm the academic director at Friendship Academy.
Nell Collier, Executive Director, Friendship Academy of the Arts.
And we benefit greatly from the extended time that our students get. Right now we get about 13,045, as well as with Best Academy. A lot of our curriculum and activities are aligned in the same direction. We sit here to say that we know it worked because we are a school that has come from behind to be in front. We have led from being closed 5 years ago, sitting at 20% in mathematics and 40% in reading. Well, we sit here today at 80% in mathematics and 57%, that's last year's data. But all I say is just watch out for the new data that's getting ready to come forth because we will take number one in the state.
Thank you. And I know that confidence comes from a lot of hard work. So thank you.
Yes.
Go ahead, ma'am. Did you have something else you wanted to add?
Just saying thank you.
Thank you.
With the students coming from behind, it does come from hard work because we recognize the extended time is something that we can use not only just during the school day, but we can extend that school year because we come back with a number of gaps from summer lag. So being able to bring them in and kind of pave some of that so that they're not having to start from behind again and have that frustration. So allowing charters to have some of that opportunity. And I would agree, a student is a student irrespective of what school they're in. Either we respect them as a student and say that a charter is student is just as equal to a traditional public student, and I'm not certain as to why we make a difference between children.
Thank you. Senator Pratt had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for the testifiers, I'm wondering, my familiarity is with response to intervention. How are you using or how will you use, excuse me, I've got a frog in my throat, the extended the funds for extended time or extended support, is it for staff salary, or do you have specific programs that you're investing in?
Specifically from academic, because I speak from the academic director piece, not so much. It would definitely have some benefit toward staff salary because we would need staff there in order to work with students, so we would have to compensate them. So part of that would be allowing the children to have more time, where they have more targeted services. Luckily for us, we're building wide targeted services, so we're able to get in there. But even with the great performance, we still have a gap. We have a gender gap For us, our special ed children are outdoing our general ed children. So we have a different dynamics that's happening at our school. So it would be on the new Common Core that has been put out there. We did Common Core, and we had a little time to look at it, but we haven't had enough time to really get in there and see how Common Core needs to be really applied, because it isn't going to be the same for every child or every teacher. So more opportunities for training to adjust to that new level. We have new mathematics standards that are going to be looked at in 2016 and due to be implemented in 2019. So we have to think ahead in regards to that as well. Giving them more time during the summer where they're having more constructive things to do. Right now there are no outlets for children. They're not that there aren't any, but there are limited outlets for our children during the summertime of what type of activities they can engage in. So why not make it learning?
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Other questions? All right. Thank you all. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. And I have Josh Downham with Minneapolis Public Schools.
Madam Chair, members, Josh Down, Minneapolis Public Schools. I'll be very brief. We support the House position to increase extended time revenue. And as we've shared with you, Madam Chair, and Senator Wieger, when you met with Superintendent Gore, extended time revenue really means a lot to the students, at-risk students in Minneapolis. And a couple of the ways I want to highlight today how we use those revenues, revenue dollars. We use a spring and winter break academies where students actually attend instead of going home and doing what I did as a kid, probably sitting on the couch, not doing much. We had 3,400 students this past spring break attend our spring break academy. Of those, 2,000 students actually attended every single day. Those students receive transportation, meals. They receive instruction and enrichment opportunities. And we have seen, we don't actually have the MCA data for this particular year, but the past year, they outperformed their peers on both math and reading. And one of the, our REA director, Eric Moore, said in particular, these academies and our summer programs that use these same dollars allow these students to make stronger connections with staff, helps them create a growth mindset and see themselves as achieving high standards, and really kind of breaks that shell, frankly, that multiple risk factors create around a student. So where you, if you have, say, one risk factor, strong instruction can break through that. But when you have multiple risk factors layered on top of each other, you really need that additional time, additional resources dedicated. This is one of those ways that we do that, and we appreciate the additional resources in the bill, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Downham? All right, seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, and so now I think we'll turn to those who would wish to testify on early learning scholarships. And I'm just going to call up individuals by, are there two or three seats up there? There's three. We'll go ahead and fill three seats at a time to minimize time in moving people in and out. And again, I would ask people to be brief, and if you can, to try not to repeat things that have been already said. Barb Yates, Barbara Milan, and Carolyn Smallwood.
Madam Chair.
Welcome.
Members of the committee. Madam Chair, I appreciate your invitation to discuss, yes, for a couple of items off of the Early Learning Council's recommendations. And you asked me specifically to address ParentAware and the scholarship recommendations. The governor's executive order created the Early Learning Council. It's also in Minnesota statute, and it's in federal statute. We are charged to figure out the most effectively create a high-quality early childhood system in Minnesota. And we have been working to do that over the past 4 years. We've held learning sessions throughout the state with parents and stakeholders in this system. We've reviewed current research and evaluation of early learning programs, and we review and oversight of the activities that have been under the Minnesota Race to the Top. We're very proud of the gains that the state has made in the last 4 years with that effort and with the effort of all players. We believe this is an exciting time. Everybody's talking about early learning. We have some making up to do to get our systems aligned, and we have a lot of underfunded systems. Prior to the legislative session, the Early Learning Council put forward recommendations in the area, continuing what we had a couple of years ago, and that the governor led $46 million in scholarship funding into that. So we wanted to continue the increase of early learning scholarships. We had some recommendations for the child care assistance program and some home visiting. The governor's, when he came out, was way bolder than we were in what he thought we would be able to accomplish and do. And so we wanted to add some recommendations to the conversation going forward with so many proposals on the table. And to that end, we issued a report. We have provided you with that, and I won't go through all of those recommendations, but wanted you to see those. And those are basically based on what we've heard from people, what we've learned, how we can build on what's going on, hopefully lift up those things that are getting good results and help us move forward into a good system. We agree with others that I know you've been hearing from. We do believe there needs to be more money on the table in order to address these challenges. The specific proposal you asked me about was our recommendation on early learning scholarships, and we talk about increasing funding for those scholarships to build out a scholarship system with 3- and 4-year-olds. Because of the universal pre-K proposal, we think that has to be figured into how that gets costed, perhaps, and we also looked at the issue of more flexible scholarships. The funding that we proposal that we put with that, the numbers we put with that, would accomplish the following. We asked for an additional $98 million per year. That build-out would include $5,000 per child scholarships for those children that are in the 100 to 185% of poverty. And for those children who are 100% of poverty or less, we would ask for more flexibility in those scholarships being able to be a larger amount, and that builds on current funding. Those numbers were derived from calculations done by Rob Grunewald from the Federal Reserve Bank, looking at those children who currently are not in any programs and would still fit this criteria. We do assume the governor's funding proposals for child care assistance and for the Head Start program. In the Parent Aware rating system, our proposals there is we recommend that we continue building out that system. We think there has been good progress, but we also have some counties that have just in the last few months had the opportunity to join into that process. So we think that we, as I said, we've made progress. We're about 2,000 programs now. Thousands of children have access to higher quality seats than they did before we did this. We're also seeing good movement in the most recent evaluations of programs that have come in at 1 or 2 stars moving up to higher level stars. But we do still have work to do here. So we would our request is that we continue the trajectory of the building out that system that we have been on with the resources from Race to the Top, and that we add some additional resources to the governor's proposal to allow us to stay at that level.
And I'm sorry, did you have a specific recommendation on the funding required for Parent Aware to continue?
We would need, assuming that the governor's proposal is funded, it would be an additional $10 million for the biennium.
Thank you. Thank you. Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Barbara Milan. I'm the executive director at Phyllis Wheatley Community Center, and I am a member of the Many Minds Advisory Committee and the Executive Committee. I am here this afternoon to urge you to continue the recommendation to invest in preschool scholarships. We know from the research, we know from the participation of our children and our Child Development Center at Phyllis Wheatley that our children do well when we invest in them at a very early age. The research has been documented by our local economist, Mr. Rolnick, and also Mr. Grunwald. On the national studies, we can look to the Abercidian report, and we can look to the Highscope Perry report. This is the best strategy, the best investment by the state of Minnesota in closing the achievement gap. Our children enter school. They are ready to learn. They have the social skills. They have the cognitive skills. We work with our families, and our belief is that with our family supporting our children, working with our schools, working with the teachers, that we can be successful, and our data does support that. So we want to, again, urge you to support preschool scholarships. The state of Minnesota has a very great opportunity in terms of being a leader in the country and the investment of preschool child development scholarships. We want to have the flexibility of the scholarships. I'm very encouraged to learn that the proposed legislation would remove the cap. And so we also want to have the flexibility so that it supports three-year-old children and also our four-year-old children. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Rolnick.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to talk about the importance of investing more in early learning scholarships for our most at-risk kids. As many of you probably know, now I'm Art Rolnick, by the way, and I'm formerly Director of Research at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. I'm now a Senior Fellow at the Humphrey Institute. And as many of you know, you're living in one of the best economies in this country. In fact, probably one of the best economies in the world. A number of years ago when I was at the bank, we asked the question, what sustained? Why was Minnesota such a successful economy? I was pretty sure it wasn't the weather, but that's a factor. We had data going back to 1920, from 1920 in the year 2000. And one surprise is we weren't always such a good economy. In fact, between 1920 and 1950, we were well below the national average. So sometime in 1950, this economy takes off. And by the year 2000, we're one of the top six, seven economies in the country. So question, how did that happen? We looked at a lot of factors, and one was obvious. We, in the 50s, and I don't have the history on why this occurred in the 50s, but we started to pour money into education, into human capital. And human capital, as you well know, is a critical ingredient for sustained economic growth. And so today, for example, if you look at our education metrics, our women are like number one in high schools. We got some of the smartest women in the world. We have one of the strongest workforces in the world. And I'm going to argue that's causal. Fortune 500 companies, we're number one or number two in the country per capita. Again, it's closely related to the quality of our workforce. So things look good. Good economy. However, as you well know and as other speakers have pointed out, we've got an achievement gap. We've got too many of our workers falling behind, not graduating high school. This economy, that's going to be a pretty tough prediction to say how, you know, it's going to be very difficult for those students to compete in this economy. My hometown is Detroit. I'll use an extreme example. 75% of the children in the Detroit public schools do not graduate or do not graduate on time. It's close to a third-world economy now. It'll look like that 20 years from now if they don't educate their children. Okay. So I don't think there's much disagreement amongst educators, economists, that you want to build your human capital. Minnesota's been a leader on that for so many years. So why do we talk about early childhood education? Because that's where it begins. Neuroscience research will tell you 90% of the brain is developed by age 5. If we don't get to our most at-risk kids and make sure they're healthy and ready to learn, James Heckman, Nobel laureate, University of Chicago, shows nationally, if they start well behind, they don't catch up on average. So it's critical that our kids start healthy and ready to learn. So there's an organization back in 2006 was established based on our research that decided to see if... I'm sorry.
Yeah. We just have to vote.
Excuse me. The senators have to leave for a vote.
Oh.
And so.
Well.
Senator Wieger said we could continue with testimony, if that's all right. So, okay. So we'll go ahead and continue while they're away.
So the it's very clear that it starts early. Health starts early. Your commissioner of health is speaking on really on the same issue across the hall on the importance on starting early. So this organization called the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation was created back in 2006. And it's made up of the top CEOs in this state. I think you're going to hear from Mike Cerisi later in this hearing. Mike was on this committee. Mostly business, but we had a variety of people, president of the University of Minnesota. We had Blue Cross Blue Shield was involved with this. And we decided to see if we could take the research and put it into practice, actually make it work. So we raised and Dwayne Benson, a former colleague of yours, was the executive director. We raised $20 million privately to see if we could pilot a program based on the research and get the results. So what was this pilot? What was the research? So the research says, as I have to start early, the research says focus on the most at-risk kids. Why was that? That was the 18. We got an 18% inflation-adjusted return on investing in high-quality early childhood education. That comes out of longitudinal studies. So focus on at-risk children, start early, make sure it's quality, because if it's not quality programs, you're not going to get these results. And finally, and maybe as critical as anything else I'm going to talk about, engage and empower the parents. I can tell you right now, if you get an engaged and empowered parent, odds are that child's going to do very well. So those were the critical ingredients. So what did MELF come up with? Again, very business-oriented. Everything is very transparent. Very simple. Our proposal that Grunewald and I made was early learning scholarships, flexible, including funding that could start as early as prenatal. So for some of these most at-risk kids, we could start with home visiting nurses. The research on that's incredible. You can lower infant mortality, lower increase birth weight, full term, reduce addiction. We have something like half the kids born on white earth right now are addicted. You're not going to close that achievement gap if you don't get to those kids early. So the MELF scholarship went out. We piloted. We created a rating system. We have to be able to get quality. We created Parent Aware. And then we targeted that program in St. Paul, in Frogtown. 650 scholarships went out. And I can tell you it's been extremely successful, exactly what the research said. The latest results showed roughly 29% of those kids in that community, on average, start school ready. Our scholarship kids, 75%. Because of the success of that model and the leadership of Governor Mark Dayton, we got a Race to the Top grant to replicate what we did in St. Paul, in North Minneapolis, on White Earth, and in Itasca County. We call them our four transformation zones, and we're getting incredible returns in every zone. A parent is a parent. Give them that kind of power and give them that opportunity, and watch out. Our kids in the Northside Achievement Zone, when they graduate from their early childhood based center program, we give them a T-shirt. And on that T-shirt is a date when they're going to graduate college. That's our expectations. That's what this kind of investment will mean. So we're replicating that now. Northside Achievement Zone got returns that look like this 18%. White Earth and Itasca County, they have waiting lists. The word is out about these scholarships. We're way underfunding them, people. We need to bring those to scale. So let me just conclude by saying it's been great so far in the sense that we've been able to establish these pilots and show that it works. It's getting national attention, international attention. Harvard Business School wrote this up as a case study. We have a number of governors and mayors starting to replicate scholarship models around the country, but Minnesota is the leader. And I urge you to increase that funding significantly. We're serving about 10% of the kids. And we will show you, it's what I do at the university, we will show you these results every year. It's going to be very transparent. You're going to know whether we succeed or we fail. I'm going to argue we're only going to get better as we collect this data and we empower these parents. And I urge you to increase that funding. Long term, We're going to need about $200 million a year so that every child born in poverty in this state will get this kind of program. And I'm going to tell you that's the best economic development investment you can make. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Forsberg, would you please introduce yourself for the record?
Frank Forsberg, and I work at Greater Twin Cities United Way as Senior Vice President, and I'm here today representing the Mini Minds Coalition, which is now a coalition of more than 100 organizational members from across the state. So good afternoon, and thank you for allowing the testimony here today. The Mini Minds Coalition was created 2.5 years ago to be champions of closing the kindergarten readiness gap in our state. And the premise we had in phase one was to urge the state to provide 20,000 low-income children 3 and 4 years old with an early learning scholarship, a scholarship that would be directed by their parents to any high-quality early learning opportunity that they thought would meet the needs of their child the best. Could be a half day or full day, could be a school year or a full year. It could be a home-based program or a Head Start or a school-based program. The range of options is broad across our state. It's also diverse across our state. It's not equal. And the flexibility of a parent-directed scholarship across the state really made sense to these 100 organizational coalition members. Mr. Rolnick has already referenced the Race to the Top Transformation Zones. We are enormously pleased about the results that we've been getting in those four transformation zones, again, using the principles of parent-directed scholarships to very high-quality early learning opportunities. I'll close by just saying there are about four principles that we think would matter a great deal as you consider options in terms of moving forward with high-quality early learning opportunities. First, we are great champions of identifying and prioritizing those children who are most vulnerable and need the most support. Let's help them first. It'll be the best way to close the kindergarten readiness gap. Second, the act of engaging parents and empowering them to make the best decision for their children and their families is vital. Cultural diversity is also core to the success of this effort. Be big champions of really a diverse delivery system. Race and culture really matters in the delivery of high-quality early learning opportunities. And finally, high accountability. We want both high-quality standards on the input side, and we want the highest accountability on the kindergarten readiness side. We urge your support for advancing early childhood education, and we believe early childhood scholarships is the best way to make that happen. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Moss.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Erica Moss from Parent Aware for School Readiness. And as committee members have heard during the past months, Parent Aware for School Readiness, or PASR as it is known, strongly believes in early learning scholarships. But what we've talked about a little bit less is the high priority we also place on investing in the Parent Aware ratings. Over the last months, there's been a variety of information shared about Parent Aware, and I wanted to spend my time before the committee today telling the absolutely exciting story of what's happening all around our state in every corner of the state with regard to the Parent Aware ratings. As Ms. Yates mentioned, currently there are over 2,000 rated providers around the state. We're especially proud of recent success expanding participation among child care centers, which increased 100% in 2014, and family child care homes, which increased 150% during that time period. More providers are signing up literally every day, and growth is strong. There has been some information shared that may lead to the belief that there is not a lot of capacity in rated programs, and so I also wanted to share and am excited to share that there are 65,000 slots right now in rated programs around the state. Again, that number is growing all the time. Right now, 6 out of every 10 child care centers statewide is participating. And, of course, we all know that there are more centers in the metro area than in greater Minnesota. So I also wanted to talk about the fact that the highest child care participation rates in the state are in greater Minnesota. We have counties like Itasca with 40%, Carlton 34%, Clearwater with 35%, and so on. This participation, as I mentioned, includes a growing number of home-based child care providers. I wanted to talk, Frank mentioned the importance of diversity in our delivery system, and I wanted to talk about the fact that in Minneapolis, for example, 87% of the participating home-based child care providers are women of color. That's obviously great news. We all know how important it is for the diversity of the adults with children to match the diversity of the children they serve. Parent Aware is showing incredible results in this regard. So providers are participating and more are joining all the time. I'm happy to also report that providers are moving up the star levels. A strong majority of rated programs have earned 4 stars, and 70% of providers who have been re-rated, so rated more than one time, have moved up during their second cycle. Over time, in every single region of the state, we see this trend. The longer ratings are available, the more programs participate, and the more programs move up to the 3- and 4-star levels. So the bottom line I want to share with you is about what this means for kids. It means that increasingly Minnesota children are in and have access to child care and early education programs that are using kindergarten readiness best practices. This is important because, as we saw in the Parent Aware evaluation, children attending programs using these best practices made significant gains on important kindergarten readiness measures during their year before kindergarten. And most importantly, low-income children made greater gains. So in other words, we saw the readiness gap closing. I want to just spend a final moment, chairs, talking about some exciting research that will come out this fall. Over the last 8 years, there's been a more than $5 million investment in research related to programs, including Parent Aware. Currently, my organization and Greater Twin Cities United Way are funding the largest, most comprehensive study of child outcomes across program type that has ever been done in Minnesota. When you hear me make a statement like kids made significant gains, it may not sound that impressive, but know that the statement is phrased in that way because our assessment work is much more rigorous than a ready, not ready point in time measure. Our study has measured the progress made by 800 children during their 4-year-old year, again, across a variety of settings and across developmental domains. This is the kind of rigorous work underpinning the Parent Aware system, and I very much look forward to sharing those evaluation results with you all when they are available. And if I may, Madam Chair, just a child care provider was going to join me today. Unfortunately, her sub fell through. So I did just want to distribute some information about Mei Yang, a Hmong provider, 4-star provider in St. Paul. She was a former St. Paul Public Schools teacher. She's now running a licensed family child care out of her home, serving 10 kids, some of them with early learning scholarships. And I had a great phone conversation with her this morning, and she shared with me some incredible stories about children she's serving with scholarships. One young boy in particular, a 3-year-old, she's used the resources available through the scholarship to add transportation for that child to help him get to her program every day. She talked at length about the amazing gains that he's made being able to be in the program on that kind of a full-time, full-day basis. It's a child who has very young parents who are still completing their high school work. And so this has meant a lot to their family. And, you know, as a well-trained teacher, seeing this child every day, she couldn't stop gushing about the wonderful progress that he's made. So thank you for allowing that extra add-on.
Thank you. And committee members, if you have questions at any point, just please go right ahead. Senator Johnson.
And I don't know who might Madam Chair, I don't know who might answer this, but Mr. Rolnick, you have been very much of a star for me in terms of advocating for early intervention with children. What happens with the children who are staying home with their mothers or fathers and I would say maybe are not getting very high-quality child care? Is there a way that they are included in this program?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair. Very good question. I serve on Mayor de Blasio's advisory panel, and they've gone citywide with a Early Ed 4 program. And what they're finding is that the uptake is mostly middle-class families. That is, what you have to do with the most at-risk families is provide mentors and provide mentors as early as you can. And once that bonding goes on with the mentor, then we get our families using the scholarships and going to these programs. So it's not just good enough to say we've got a program. You can have wonderful programs out there, but if you don't get the most at-risk families into the programs, you're failing. So one thing New York City is starting to look at is, again, starting earlier and starting providing mentors to these families as early as they can. If you don't do that, I'm afraid, generally speaking, you're gonna miss our most high-risk, we call them our most high-return children, because we make such a difference in their lives. So it takes a little bit more heavy lifting. This is what the Northside Achievement Zone is doing in Minneapolis. They have what they call connectors, and they're working family by family, and they're on call 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. We're getting those kind of results there because we're putting that kind of effort into it family by family.
Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, I serve as an appointee to the Asian Pacific Council here and from the Senate, and I have learned a lot about their culture in that community, and many of them are very, very cautious about taking their children into daycares and so forth, and they also have other issues. So it seems to me that schools are really a good place because people, especially some of the people that are not as involved with the community as some of us are, that the one thing that they are somewhat trusty of is schools. So it seems to me that that's a very good place for them.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, absolutely. We've got some superintendents around Minnesota, around the country, that are intimately involved with early childhood education, and they still use some of the infrastructure like a Montessori. They may partner with a Montessori, but they'll be out there leading, and we need that kind of leadership community by community. I can tell you the leadership on White Earth is amazing, and it's that kind of leadership that's culturally sensitive, that gets the parents involved and gets them into a variety of different type of schools, and the public schools are critical if we're going to take this to scale. So there is no question we need leadership in the public schools, and we need to get to the kids early.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Relnick. All my three schools that I represent have great preschool programs, but they also tell me that they love the idea that we're promoting these scholarships that can be centered on the students that really need it. I think that's what I'm hearing from the people today, that we should center the scholarships on those that really need the scholarships. Am I correct?
You're correct. And let me point out that all kids need high quality education and high quality early ed. We know we have limited dollars. Our research says by far the best public return is starting with our most at risk. But I know we can build a universal system with scholarships. You would means test them, but start with our most at risk. And I think there's general agreement around the country. If you look at former Governor Jeb Bush, who had me speak a number of years ago, he was way ahead of this in Florida. If you listen to the President of the United States today and his proposal, it's starting at the most at-risk kids and starting as early as possible. I think there's general agreement with that. Focus it on our most at-need. Like I said, we call those our high-return children. It's, in my mind, unconscionable from an economic point of view. Former Governor Alcui will tell you from a moral point of view. I'll tell you from an economic point of view. You're getting that kind of high return. There's no business person that wouldn't fully fund it.
Thank you.
Questions? All right. I think we'll go to our next testifier. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carol Miller. I'm a senior manager for Hennepin County Human Services and Public Health Department. I've been asked to speak to you very briefly about the investments Hennepin County has been making in flexible scholarships for county-involved young children, as well as our commitment to increasing the quality of childcare in our communities. In 2013, the Hennepin County Board supported a study of county-involved youth, older children, that is, across various programs that we have responsibility for. One of the things that we learned was that many of those youth were known to us in one program or another before they were 1 year or 2 years old. We've taken a number of actions based on that learning, but I'll describe only two. We decided to focus more attention first on assuring that the quality of child care services to our lower income families was able to support children's development and learning. In 2014, we invested $250,000 to pay the costs of offering free training to family child care providers and center staff in Hennepin County, particularly training and supports that match the guidelines of the Parent Aware Quality Rating System. This offer was very enthusiastically received, especially by licensed family child care providers, many more of whom have volunteered for Parent Aware, having had that opportunity. This year, we will again invest similarly with a current commitment of over $200,000 for training and supports for our child care providers. A second and related investment has been in flexible scholarships for county-involved young children, ages birth to kindergarten. Last year, the investment was $1 million, and this year, our county and board increased that commitment to nearly $2 million. They did so because of the impact and successes that we are seeing with the program of flexible scholarships for our county-involved little kids, and their belief that investment can improve the developmental and educational outcomes for young children under our jurisdiction. Also, a hope that high-quality early learning can provide a boost to the children and their families, perhaps to ultimately move them to be less likely to repeat the cycles of poverty and family distress they often are currently experiencing. Very briefly, our target population for scholarships includes foster children, ages birth to five, both those in relative care and those in our licensed foster homes, children under child protection services that are still living with their parents or returning to their parents, children whose parents are disabled or mentally ill and receiving our case management services, a few adolescent parents who have no other way of covering child care, and most recently we added some young children of homeless families, all of those very high-risk categories of children that we have some responsibilities for. Our early childhood scholarships are characterized by flexibility to meet the individual needs, up to full-time services for 6 months at a time, which can be renewed, payment at market rates, which significantly increases the access we have, placement in high-quality programs identified either by high parent aware ratings and or accreditation. This is a relatively new effort. We don't yet have data on long-term outcomes. However, anecdotally, social workers, providers, and families are all telling stories of the impact that flexible scholarships are having on the children and their situations. I will end with a couple of examples. A single working woman was able to take on the foster care of all three of her young nieces and nephew because she was guaranteed access to stable, high-quality child care. She reports that the children are thriving in this new setting, and she is so happy to be able to help her family members. It was a twofer. It provided a stable setting for the children, and the children are thriving in a high-quality learning setting. Second example, a very depressed young mother was able to receive intensive day treatment because her infant and her three-year-old were enrolled in high-quality care, where they received the stimulation and interaction with other adults that's often missing in the parenting of a mentally ill parent. In turn, the mother has been able to get a daily break and to focus on her own recovery and is doing much better. In summary, the Hennepin County Board chose to invest in flexible scholarships in high-quality settings because we wanted to improve the outcomes for high-needs, county-involved young children. These investments are only able to reach a limited number of children under our jurisdiction. That's our target. We have limited dollars. But we are seeing much enthusiasm and success from these efforts, and we do hope to see much more opportunity in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, to the lady at the end, thank you. Please introduce yourself.
My name is Ayan Barre. I am a Somali-American. I'm talking on behalf of Somali community, which I did spend a lot of time to discuss that so many different community, and I talked about the scholarship, and I'm telling you, if the scholarship goes to the public school, I am telling you there is no Somali parent will trust put their kids there, that school, unless they have a choice. They put, I think this year is the most kids went to education early childhood because of a lot of child care open in our community, and it's really successful. And a lot of them, they have good quality, and they would like to put their own place. They feel comfortable, and it's 4 years old and 3 years old. They would like to have place they can have recognized over their kids and similar. If you guys, please, let them choose the scholarship from the parent and have a choice they can put their kids, which I have the same thing, because I put my child Montessori, and that was my choice. But please consider and give the parent for the scholarship.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chad Dunkley. I am president of the Minnesota Child Care Association, representing about 250 child care centers all around the state of Minnesota. We care for a little over 30,000 children a day, also CEO of New Horizon Academy. And I want to thank both the House and Senate for considering increased investments for Minnesota's youngest learners. This is an exciting opportunity. And I'm here to urge you to support a system we've been building for over a decade, a system that's lifting and raising the quality all around the state for all early childhood settings for children birth to five. And I think it's sad that there's controversy surrounding the path, and I see the commissioner here, and I just want to say there's more controversy in St. Paul than there is actually out there in practice. There are many providers and school districts all partnering, and really scholarships, half of them are being spent in public schools, and that's how it should be. There is a place for public schools with early learning, but what the system we've created is really about empowering parents and just giving them choice. And providers, nobody gets a free ride. Every provider, when you use a scholarship system, each week has to earn the trust of families and has to do a high-quality job for children. And parents have the power to say, this isn't working for my family, and choose another provider. But we love that public schools are involved. I do a lot of collaborating, and I love the work we're doing together. But this path that we're on, it really does incentivize raising the quality for birth to five. We're seeing wonderful stories all across the state. In fact, Minnesota just passed Massachusetts as the highest percentage of center-based providers who are nationally accredited. That's the gold standard in early childhood. That's exciting. That happened because of parent-aware and scholarships. And, you know, if we're going to go universal, let's just do one that includes parent choice. A vast majority of states who do universal pre-K use everybody who wants and are committed to do quality work with young children. Why push anybody away from the table? Let us all be there. Collaborating, we do our best work. And so we certainly want you to consider that. But today, our system is built on improving the care for all. The current path is getting national recognition, as Art mentioned, from White Earth. We have an example. It's working there. It's working in Itasca County. It's working in the Northside Achievement Zone. It's working all over the state. So there's no reason we can't work together on a system that becomes universal. Scholarships could be universal. Let's just start by targeting those resources to the lowest income families. We can do a sliding fee for higher income families and help everyone. The governor has a great tax plan that could help middle income families. We want to help everybody. And I think you may have heard me say this, or some of you, but we have a limited number of life jackets in government, and we have to throw those to children who are still in the water, not ones at a lifeboat. And the way we're infusing new resources in this system is lifting the whole system forward. And current brain research says if we wait till four, we're too late. Stanford said by two years old, low-income families or low-income children are 6 months behind their peers in language development. By five, they're 2 years behind. By five, they've heard 30 million less words than their high-income counterparts. So we don't want to wait till four. We don't want to focus all our resources there. Let's keep infusing resources that lifts the system for all. And once those children are in good care and they're experiencing wonderful things, birth to five, let's work on a universal plan. There's exciting things happening all around the country. But we want to work together. We're here to work together. We want to thank the governor and the House for also funding Parent Aware. Scholarships and Parent Aware go together. You heard 60% of licensed child care centers are now in Parent Aware. That's a huge number. It's voluntary. We have all these providers who want to do a better job, who are excited and want to fulfill the commitments and promise of building and increasing the readiness of children, no matter what their race, ethnicity, income. We want to be at the table. We want to do a good job. And there are providers all across the state trying to do that. And I have to tell you, I was really moved on the way here. I had a center director send me a letter about a scholarship family, and I have the letter to share with you. It was about an hour before I left. But it's a story about Michael, who's age 3. He came to us about a year ago, and we weren't at that time concerned with letters, numbers, shapes, colors, writing, or anything we were working on with other 3-year-olds. We were teaching him to trust us, not only our teachers, but himself. And now, a year later, quality education and care for Michael is happening. He's motivated. He's ready to learn. And I can tell you, he would not have access without a scholarship, and Michael will be ready for school. It's really exciting what's happening. And there are Michaels all across the state that are benefiting from the work that's been done on early learning, and these scholarships will matter. It'll matter for families. It'll matter for committed providers, and we will fulfill our commitment of doing a great job if you expand early learning scholarships. So we thank you for that, and we're excited to partner to help children do better all across the state.
Thank you. Welcome. If you please state your name for the record.
Yes, I'm Marianne Barrows-Wark, and I'm here speaking on behalf of Jewish Community Action, which has worked for years on affordable housing and children's issues that are so crucial to the health of the youth and families. I, like most of us, are disturbed that we have the largest achievement gap for Blacks, Native Americans, and Latinos in the country. I've also been advocating for early childhood for 3 decades, a little bit more because my son is now 36. And I'm here to speak in favor of the early learning scholarships aimed at the most needy of our community's young children. I've taught 4-year-olds. It's not that I don't like 4-year-olds. I just retired from teaching 4-year-olds. They're wonderful children, but it is the first 3 years that really, really count, and that's where our money should be going. Why? The first has to do with well-established child development theory. Now, I don't mean the kind of theory that most people have about how you raise children. Most people have a default, which is the way I was raised, or the opposite of the way I was raised. And actually, that's been researched. That's what most people think of as child development. But really, there's been a lot of money in the last 3 decades put into studying what really does work and how is it that children develop. Several years ago, about 10 years ago, Brio and 0-3 did a study and found out that 98% of Americans knew that the brain developed in the first 3 years, but they had no idea what that meant. They had no idea how to accomplish that. Well, the researchers that we know have figured that out. It has to do with relationships. And a steady, consistent, stable relationship of an adult, a caring, loving adult with a young child. And the more stable, the more consistent, the better. And we also know that inconsistent, variable, different kinds of relationships, one this day and another day, can be damaging to children. So it's very important. If a family is poor, that in itself is destabilizing. Housing insecurity, another destabilizing factor. Family dysfunction, another destabilizing factor. Health problems, another destabilizing factor. Stable, consistent, well-trained child care providers can add a huge amount of stability for any child. Unless the child has that from 0-3, though, it's difficult for that child to feel comfortable. And you have to be comfortable. You have to know who you are and what the relationship is before any child can start to play, start to explore, start to ask questions, say, what's that? What's that? They have to do it with somebody they know, that's somebody who's going to react with them. So the scholarships for the 0-5 age are even more valuable than half a day of preschool for 4-year-olds, because it is the child care educators and the child as a team that adds the dose of stability, the secure relationship for the child And I'd argue for the family, because the parents also get a partner in raising their child. And that kind of community is not so easy today for most families. Where there aren't extended family members around, you have to find your support wherever you can. We know from research that the more training a provider has, the more likely he or she will remain in the profession. And this is where Parent Aware comes in, because there's so much training that's involved, additional training often, and that helps keep the providers in the business. Well, if they're in the business, then a family's provider doesn't say, oh, I'm not going to be here next week or next month. It means that the provider will stay in business and stay with that child. Another thing that the research shows is that a child does better when its native language is used in that first 3 years. The number of words a child hears makes a huge difference in how ready a child is for kindergarten. And it isn't a TV or screens that make that difference. It's relating with a human being that they know. So the input for the child should be with someone who is in their own community. Also, I wanted to say, and I'm sure it's been said before here this afternoon, that the scholarships program and the Parent Aware have not only been piloted, evaluated, scaled to the whole state, why would we give up on increasing the number of children who are eligible for scholarships from 10%? We can do better. And especially when we know that the evaluations in the St. Paul Promise neighborhood that was recently finished, 70% of the kids with scholarships were ready for K, compared with 20% of the children without them. Wow, that's fantastic. We should keep going. So I'm in favor of the early learning scholarships being increased, because it's aimed at the crucial early years of 0 to 5. It is targeted at those who need them most, and because it allows for diverse choices. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator Franson, welcome.
Thank you, Representative Loon, Chair Loon, and senators and representatives. Just a quick, brief involvement of how I got involved in the scholarships, if you all have a minute to indulge me. Since I was elected in 2012 in my first session, I have been a supporter of scholarships and signed on to support the scholarships. And my second year here in the Senate, as the supplemental budget bill came forward. So the first round, we did fund the scholarships at a great level. That was a first, you know, step, but there was a lot of momentum towards that. Last year, we did a little bit better in terms of continuing to fund that, but this year we have a great opportunity to continue that progress, and that is why I'm here today. Little do people know that I actually got involved in this issue way before the legislature as well, and that's why I'm particularly passionate about the issue. When I was president of the Minnesota Hispanic Bar Association, we actually, during my term, we actually started a scholarship for early childhood education with Joyce Preschool, who I'm pleased to be able to introduce today, who's also going to be testifying today. And we did that because we realized that there was a need, and again, not only achievement gap need, but as lawyers, we knew that there was also a need for diversity in the lawyer, in the attorney field. So we did that, and that still to this day is moving forward, and there's a bar event that we do every year with Joyce Preschool to support that scholarship program and overall funding. So when it came to the legislature and found that that Mini Minds was really pushing forward to that, it was an eventual natural fit for me. I'm part of the Senate. I know we have a smaller target in the Senate of $5 million. I know we can do better, so I'm here to say that I'm part of the minority in the Senate who really wants the scholarships to be moving forward, and I do, in this particular case, favor the House position on this appropriation, and I hope that this committee does move forward with funding for scholarships. I think it. I also am a signatory of the all-day preschool program that the governor is supporting, and I do that because it's about getting our kids ready for K. So it starts for all our kids. But I do believe that the targeted approach that the scholarships has is the best way to move forward, especially because of the limited resources and because we know that that's where we have the most progress that we can make in terms of closing our gaps in learning and that we can't leave anyone behind. So I would rather prefer that we move forward with targeted funding for scholarships this year and move forward. And someday maybe we'll be able to get there. But right now, with limited resources, I think this is the best investment for our state. I'm here in support of the scholarships, and I want to turn it over to Laura Tompkins, who's the new executive director of Joyce Preschool, who I've known for many years, and certainly want to give her the opportunity to talk about how Joyce Preschool got involved in the scholarships and their experience with them and the great benefits that they're doing with our community, especially in communities of color. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Franz. And I think they've just called a roll call apparently in the Senate. So we will actually take about a 5 to 7 minute recess so you guys can go vote and everybody can stretch maybe a little bit. And we'll come back, and like I said, in about 5 to 7 minutes. Oh, all right.
We'll let you know, Senator.
That's all right. My vote doesn't count.
Oh, I was going to say.
It's
not real hard. Push the red button.
Anything to drink? Yeah, I'm going to go to Mountain Dew. You want anything? Hey, Coke or something? How about you?
I should head up anyway, just in case.
Jody?
Hi.
Dan.
See you in a bit. That's right. That's right. I think my brain. That's right.
Committee members, we'll resume after our brief recess with testimony. All right, thank you. Is it Ms. Tompkins?
Yes, thank you.
Please go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and provide your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Laura Tompkins, and I'm the Executive Director of Joyce Preschool. And I am representing this great program, which is a bilingual Spanish-English two-way immersion program. We teach all of our subjects in English and in Spanish with teachers who are native speakers of one language or the other, but who are bilingual in order to communicate effectively with our families. We are a NAACI-accredited, nationally accredited program and a Minnesota 4-star parent-aware rated site. And we are also a 501c3 nonprofit, and we give out scholarships to at least half of our students every school year. We've maintained that commitment to scholarshiping since we were founded in the 1960s. Another core component of our model is diversity. Our program curriculum is developed around many different cultures and celebrates and affirms those cultures. We have teachers from many countries, many different Spanish-speaking countries, who bring cultural elements that are unique and that enrich our program, and we invite our families to participate and to share from their cultures as well. We believe that this cultural celebration and diversity is what sets Joyce apart and supports and affirms and engages all of our parents. We also have a parent outreach coordinator who works closely with our families through home visits and who coordinates parent workshops and also school-wide events such as the potluck that we're having tonight at Joyce. This parent involvement is a key piece to our success. We have 100% of our students graduating kindergarten ready the last 3 years, and over 90% kindergarten ready the last 10 years. We believe that parent involvement is one of the reasons we're able to achieve these outcomes for our kids. The families being present in school, being engaged, and also being able to come to us as a school and receive support and help with questions that they're facing is critical to their success. I would like to introduce Naya, who is a Joyce parent, and she's going to share a little bit about her perspective as a parent and how she came to find Joyce and her experience receiving a scholarship to attend Joyce. Thank you.
Welcome. If you please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Naya Owens, parent for Joyce. This is my son's first year, so we started in August. I received a scholarship, which I was made aware of through a program through one of the home visiting programs that I did, Way to Grow. and just kind of happened to stumble upon that program when we missed an appointment at one of our South Minneapolis locations, and I decided to go to Pilot City, North Point for that appointment and ran into one of their representatives. But I was given the information. I called and applied and was told to look on the Parent Aware site, and it gave lots of different overwhelming information at some point, but I already knew what I was looking for, and I wanted him to be in a bilingual program because at the time we were in South Minneapolis, and our neighbor had a little boy who spoke Spanish, was his native language, and here you got two kids who are trying to play with each other, same age, every day, yelling out their bedroom windows across, you know, at each other, and their communication was limited. But to watch them still play, I thought that was pretty cool. So I found Joyce on Parent Aware and went and visited and signed up, and he's been there, and they took him, and they take care of him, and I love it.
Thank you. Thank you. That's a great story. I really thank you for that testimony.
I think I just wanted to add, I like the option, the choice to choose, and not to say that I need to it has to be certain, a certain program or a certain school. I've listened to a lot of testimony out here, and I understand everything that's going on and trying to get the kids into school and programs and be ready for kindergarten, although I have not heard anything about teaching these children a second language at the at the same time, as I think that's very important, especially with the inner city Minneapolis. Our communities are so diverse with Hmong, Somali, and Mexican. I think that's an important piece, but that's just my opinion. But thank you.
Thank you. Representative Crescia, did you have a question?
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm sorry, I want to make sure I get the name right again. What was the name?
Naya.
Naya. This first name?
Yes.
And last name?
Owens.
Owens. Okay, Ms. Owens. So one of the things that you talked about, which I think is very important, was the parental choice and the parental involvement. And all the research absolutely suggests that that's vital to this. Tell me how this has helped you with your parental involvement in your child as you've gone through this decision making.
It allowed me to choose a program that would continue what I was doing at home. Like I stated, I found out about the scholarship through Way to Grow, and Way to Grow actually helped me. I was focused more on reading, writing, colors, the basics of what I knew. I'm not a teacher, but when they came out, you know, they helped me with fine motor skills and other things of that nature. And with that program, it just made me realize you don't know it all, even though you're the parent. You got the core idea, but you still need help. And with Joyce, it I explained walking in the door my concerns and what he was not used to, and that was a scheduled day or, you know, a curriculum. He had never been to daycare before. He was always at home with me. And even through a couple of his tantrums, you know, they didn't send him home and tell me not to bring him back. And there's a lot of parent involvement, and they encourage us to participate with volunteering. And he actually likes that I'm, you know, at a school volunteering and reading to the other kids. He loves to read. And it's a great place because it just continues to – it allowed me to choose a place to add on to what my goals are for my son.
And just a follow-up, and I think you've said it about six times. I tried to count – that you enjoyed making the choice, that you were able to do your research and you were able to choose. And I just sounds like you're very proud of that, and not only that, but it's been very beneficial.
Definitely. Definitely. And I'm here for Joyce, but I have two other children who are older, so I appreciate the choice of being able to choose the programs that my kids participate in and the level, the quality of education or the quality of the program itself that I get to choose, and not being told when they can start and what programs they have to participate in.
I think we should add a couple extra dollars and make her our poster person.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome. Please go ahead and state your name for the record.
Dr. Stephen Hughes. Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for this opportunity to be here and speak in support of continuing and expanding early learning scholarships, particularly for children in need. I have some brief exhibits that I wanted to share with you just because I think it's much easier to consider these concepts if we can have a visual. It's not a lot of them, and I won't talk a lot about any one of them, but I'm going to talk about these a little bit. I want to begin by saying that the questions that preoccupy us in our lives drive our behavior, and I'm sure for each of you, one of the questions that drove your path to the table you're sitting at is, how can we build a better society? And certainly one of the answers to that question, how can we build a better society, is actually in the form of, comes in the form of another question, which of course is, how can we close the achievement gap between more privileged children and disadvantaged children? And part of the answer to that question fundamentally comes down to, how can we help every developing brain get its best shot? How can we help every developing brain get its best shot? I'm sure everyone in the room understands that some children have better opportunities than others. The point that I think needs to be made is that we know an awful lot about how to help every developing brain get its best shot. So I'm going to very briefly hit on some of the high notes. For starters, beginning in the upper left corner of the first page, this is how the sensory and motor systems of the brain are organized. You probably are more familiar with the way that your body looks when you look in the mirror in the morning, but in fact, this guy here on the bottom right of the top of the first page, that guy's called the sensory motor homunculus. And while he may haunt your dreams at night, this is your brain's representation of your body. And there's a couple of easy points to make off of that illustration. One is, human brains are substantially about our hands. And one of the ways that we help every developing brain get its best shot is we give it opportunities to use its hands to learn about things. No mystery there. Anybody who's ever driven a car knows that no matter how many times you watched mom or dad or how many YouTube videos, I guess in the modern age, you could watch about how to drive a car, you really don't know anything about how to drive a car until you sit behind the wheel. Hands-on is how we learn best. And in fact, brains grow and learn about the world by engaging in hands-on experimental interactions with the environment. I'm connected in some way to the international Montessori education community, but one of my favorite quotes of Montessori's is, the hands are the prehensile organs of the mind. That's how we learn about the world. Now, this is particularly important during the first years of life. In fact, when children's language skills are still developing, they're going to learn best about the world. They're going to feed their brain the developmental experiences necessary, principally through hands-on engagement. And in fact, as children develop their language skills, they conduct an endless series of experimental interactions with the adults in their environment around the use of language. And, you know, when they finally manage to squeeze out a mama or a dada, great things happen in their environment as a consequence of that. Another point that I want to make is that, beginning to the second page, that brains continue to develop beyond the earliest years. The foundational structures are laid down in those first years. But even from 6 onward, brain development continues. It continues as a consequence of experiences that brain has in the environment. Now, when we consider the question of how can we help every developing brain get its best shot, we have to create conditions that allow that kind of activity to continue in an environment, in a secure environment that allows children to, using their hands, engage in experimental interactions with the environment. A learning environment that is content-driven, a learning environment that is specifically about telling children things they need to know, and certainly in this day and age, things they need to know to take tests, does not fulfill the requirements for that. We can blend that environment to incorporate them, but fundamentally, most early childhood settings, particularly happening in established schools, don't have the characteristics necessary to help every developing brain get its best shot. And in fact, certainly in recent years, we've been conducting a massive social experiment to determine what happens when the only thing that happens in a classroom is that children perform well on standardized tests. This trend proceeds downward. There was a time when it wasn't the most important thing that kindergartners do well on standardized tests. Now this is something that's happening. My concern is that trend will continue lower if we move pre-K into the established and worthy public school system. It's not, that's nothing wrong with that. It's just not the place where you allow children routinely to engage in the kinds of hands-on developmental experiences that help to give every developing brain its best shot. Okay, bottom of page two, there are four general frameworks to how to do school. There's a conventional framework, which is kind of the default position. We all know about that. There's a teacher in charge. There's a structured curriculum. Assessment takes the form of standardized test performance in this day and age. There's a framework that's project-based. You've heard of project-based education. That's a legit way to do school. There's a history of research on outcomes and training. It's an absolutely legitimate way to do school. We're hearing now more about things like child-centered or even the democratic model of school. There's about a 50-year swing of the pendulum between very conventional and very progressive. That's a legit way to do school. We know how to train people to do that. We know what kind of outcomes they expect. And then finally, there's a facilitated developmental framework, and that is the framework that helps build the best brains. This is an adult who's sensitive, who's aware, who develops a strong relationship and facilitates that child having opportunities to engage their hands in conducting experimental interactions with the environment. I mean, we all know this. I mean, as parents and grandparents, the things that we do have to do with facilitating our child exploring the world. The child looking at a leaf, maybe we talk about leaves. This we all know. But somehow we lose this when we are driven currently by the need to perform well on standardized tests away from a model that supports that kind of activity toward one that, because of needs for accountability, tends to narrow the scope of what's possible in school. And in fact, it's not hard to find this. I mean, the scope of what gets covered in school has been dramatically shrunk, and I think we're also all aware of that. So how do you help build better brains? Well, God help me. On the next page, you're looking at a model of a Montessori education curriculum. Now, this is one example of a high-quality early childhood environment. And I'm not here to say that there's only one example of a high-quality early childhood environment. The point that I want to make is that this nicely illustrates some of the foundational principles necessary to help every developing brain get its best shot. Montessori education has specific components, hands-on, material designed specifically, presented in a developmental sequence as a child demonstrates mastery to support the development of gross and fine motor skills, which also includes the development of self-regulation, a critical predictor of success in education and throughout all aspects of life. It also presents materials that children can learn to self-instruct themselves on language and mathematics. There's even this remarkable brain developmental component of the Montessori curriculum that specifically creates environmental enrichment in the domain of sensorial development. The way you help every developing brain get its best shot is you create an enriched environment that allows freedom of choice and movement, a range of opportunities that children can follow their developing curiosity and sense of what lights them up to engage in, one that's respectful, one that has a diverse social environment. This is actually quite interesting. It wasn't until 1978 that all the research on enriched environments showed that, hey, what do you know? You need diversity in the social environment as well. But I suppose that's not that surprising in the end. Finally, on the last page, when you do these kinds of environments well, you get remarkable outcomes. I think you'll hear more from people in the Montessori community here in the Twin Cities, but when you do this kind of environment right, you get better outcomes. In fact, you get outcomes for disadvantaged children, you get outcomes for advantaged children. This study published in the journal Science, evaluating Montessori education, and you can find that on the web if you have an interest in, showed, in fact, superior performance on early reading and mathematics skills, superior performance in executive functioning, which really is a way of talking about self-regulation. They even had stronger social skills. They had a greater commitment to justice, maybe preparing them someday to ask the question, how can we build a better society? Finally, they demonstrate dramatically less disorganized, disruptive, the kind of behavior that you see on a playground that leads to suspensions or punishment. This all is understood. These principles are not hard to do. The challenge that we're confronted by right now is that that's kind of not how regular school is set up. The concern that animates me and that drives my behavior in being here today is that this is not going to be an environment that is like a slightly simpler version of kindergarten. That's not an environment that's going to produce that. Traditional education, conventional education, has a way that they do business. There's nothing wrong with that. My mom and dad were both public school teachers. In fact, they both worked at Roosevelt High School. My dad spent his entire career at Roosevelt, okay? So there's nothing wrong with it. But if you want to help build better brains, and I think it should animate all of us to answer the question, how can we give every developing brain its best shot? It's not going to happen in a traditional, conventional educational setting where there's a teacher in charge, there's a structured curriculum, and we evaluate performance based upon knowledge and performance on standardized tests. That's not how you do it. You know, Mr. Rolnick made a very compelling presentation. Others have as well. This stuff is well understood. In fact, you know, really, we're at a point in human history where we know altogether too much about how to build better brains, how to give every developing brain its best shot. It's becoming an embarrassment that we actually don't, as a matter of routine, make provisions to do that for every child, but particularly for the disadvantaged child. I'll close by a little statement that I think captures the general ethos of a strong developmental environment. I mean, is there anything more important? Seriously, is there anything more important? You want to build a better society? Let's close the achievement gap. Let's give every developing brain its best shot. I mean, for God's sake, what else is there? Okay, so I'm going to quote Montessori, which I think describes an ethos that is about creating an environment like this. She writes, "Scientific observation has established that education is not what the teacher gives." No, that's content, okay? That's stuff you're going to take a test on. And believe me, there's things to know, right? There are things to know. There's a variety of ways to acquire them. Montessori writes, "Education is a natural process spontaneously carried out by the human individual, and is acquired not by listening to words, but by experiences upon the environment. Just like you do with your children and grandchildren, create opportunities for them to engage in experimental interactions with the environment." Montessori writes, "The task of the teacher becomes that of preparing a series of activities spread over a specially prepared environment and then refraining from obtrusive interference." That is a profound statement of the ethos of a developmental environment, the kind of environment that gives every developing brain its best shot. To do that well, you need to know how to do that well. You need to come from a profoundly developmental perspective. You need a training that specifically addresses the developmental needs of children in early childhood. There's a lot of ways to do school, but if you want to give every developing brain its best shot, you have to give them these sorts of opportunities in an environment that is designed from the ground up to do it.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Hughes.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Welcome. I don't know who wants to go next, but please just go ahead and state your name for the record. And just for the committee, I think we'll plan to wrap here about 4:35. So with the rest of the testifiers, just, you know, if we can get everybody moving through to give everyone who's on the list a chance to testify, that would be great. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Renee Campion, and I'm the head of school at Sunny Hollow Montessori, which is in the Highland Park neighborhood of St. Paul. We're a nonprofit 501c3 organization. I want to first thank Senator Cohn and Representative Kreisha for being the chief authors and all of the authors on this bill that supports early learning scholarships. Sunny Hollow has been serving preschool-aged children since 1981. In our three classrooms currently, we have about 66 preschoolers, and half of those are four-year-olds, the other half being three-year-olds. It's a mixed-age classroom, so we also have kindergarten-age children there. We have nine trained and talented educators working directly with these children to guide them in their intellectual, social, emotional, and physical development so that they can become all that they can be. As I said, we have mixed-age classrooms, and these mixed-age classrooms give children experience with other children of different ages, which is so important. We're not all the same age here, right? That experience helps them develop, and over the 3 years that they spend in the same classroom, they get to experience being the youngest, the middle, and the oldest in that environment. They also get to be with the same adults in that classroom. And as we've heard from several people now, Dr. Hughes mentioned it, Ms. Wark mentioned it, that stable, caring relationship with the adults in the environment is so critical to the development of children. It's also the stable, caring relationship of the other children as well, and the prepared environment that makes it really developmentally appropriate for this age group. The intentional design of our classrooms allow children to socialize and learn from each other, as well as take leadership in the classroom under the guidance of these adults who know them so well. The continuity and opportunity to practice these life skills as well as their academic skills in a specially prepared environment serves their development in a rich and powerful way. As research is showing, the development that happens in early childhood is so important for them to be ready for school, but I would say equally important, all the skills that they will need, their characteristics, the executive functioning skills that Dr. Hughes mentioned, prepares them for life beyond just school, because who they are developing in this age group is who they're going to be for the rest of their lives. Our half-day preschool costs about $5,900 per school year. And that's frankly out of reach for some families. We could just accept families who can afford to pay, but we don't believe in that. So we offer our own scholarships. And early on, when Parent Aware was first getting going, we joined Parent Aware as well. And so we accept those scholarships at our school. We believe that all children can benefit from a high-quality preschool like ours and other Montessori schools and other high-quality preschools like Joyce that we heard from today. And all children in those environments benefit from being with each other. That diversity is so important. I'm here today to encourage you to support the House position on increasing funding for scholarships. And if possible, go beyond what's there. Use the surplus to help every young child in need get the early education that will prepare them for success in school and in life. We need all hands on deck right now. No one program has the capacity to serve our highest risk children, and different programs meet the different needs for the children and for the families. They need to match the program with their value and have that choice. Scholarships are a flexible tool that help families and schools so that high-quality providers of all types can work with children, continue to work with children, so that they arrive at kindergarten ready to learn and to go on being all that they can be in life. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, and the committee members. I would like to extend a special thank you to our senator from my home district, and that's Kevin Dahl. And thank all of you for being on, doing this important work on this committee. I am from Northfield Montessori. My name is Megan Ray Durkin. I have a Montessori school, Montessori Children's House in Northfield Montessori. And
sorry, could you pull the microphone a little closer to you? Thank you.
And I will be brief because I think that the information I can share today is will show the advantages of the choice that parents who come to our school have and would lose if we didn't have scholarship funding and there was the implementation of the four-year-old pre-K, universal pre-K. One parent, we have a busy time of year now at our school with a lot of enrollment for next school year, new families coming, visiting, making their choices. We're a small city, and we have not a lot of choices for parents to consider. Maybe a handful of preschools and daycare centers and then a few home care providers. I continuously hear that there really is not enough choice and not enough places. And the parent that I toured on Monday was bringing a five-year-old and a three-year-old. She very much wanted them to stay with each other in a mixed-age classroom. So she came to us. That was her choice. She also is applying for assistance. And if that was not a possibility for her, then those two children would not be able to come to our school. And one further point, if we lost the four-year-olds in our program, we have three-, four-, and five-year-olds in our program, we would probably have to close. I'm a small business owner, too. So the choice would be very slim for people in our small city that if they're we're not funds going to child care centers and preschools. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Octavia. I
grew up here in Minnesota, but I come from a single-parent household. My mother was born on the south side of Chicago. We lived in the projects on the south side of Chicago. So I came here at the age of 5. And in 7th grade, I was awarded the MEP scholarship. I went to college on an academic scholarship. And so I met my husband my senior year of college. I was getting ready to graduate. We were starting a family right away. And I couldn't finish. I got sick during my pregnancy. I couldn't work. So we ended up in low-income housing, which was definitely not the plan I thought I was going to end up in for my family. Coming from a broken household, and neither one of us grew up with our fathers. So I ended up in low-income housing and met someone at a national night out, a Montessori outreach coordinator, and introduced me to Montessori education. And before that, I wanted to work. I wanted to find a way to help support my household, my family. So when my second child was 3 months old, I enrolled at a New Horizon Child Care Center. And they paid like $7 and some change an hour. And we were on assistance, child care assistance there. The money was not adding up. I mean, as much as, you know, every time I made something, they pull back. So I ended up passing by a classroom. The children were biting my children. They were kind of running a little wild. They had, and I walked by another classroom, and a teacher just was trying to calm my three-month-old down, and she kind of had him at the edge of her knee, and it was shaking him. So it scared me. It scared me to the point I told my husband, I can't do this anymore. I pulled my children out of there. It scarred me. I said, I'm not going to put my children in some public place where these people are not trained. They have a high turnover rate. They come in a uniform, and you know, they're not paid very well. So then I'm at a national night out. I meet this outreach coordinator, and she introduces me to Montessori. And I said, how are you interested in being a teacher? I said, I don't have money. I can't afford child care for my children. She said, well, let's talk about scholarship. So that's kind of how I got into learning about Montessori. So when I toured the classrooms, it was immaculate. Like, everything was at their level. They had heated floors. And I was just so shocked that my children could experience something like this, and we didn't have the money for them to do so. Like, we wasn't in a rich suburban neighborhood. We couldn't afford it. And the materials that they had, and the professionalism of the teachers, the way they dress, the food they ate, I mean, was premium. The no sugar policy. I go to public schools. I ask them, they're having donuts, Pop-Tarts for breakfast. I'm like, are you kidding me? My kids are talking about salads. They have strawberries in their salads. I never ate strawberries in my salad. Like, are you kidding me? So, you know, it was just like, wow. And the community that this school provided for my family. Me, I was this stressed out, broken, and to be vulnerable, depressed mother. I was the oldest. I was strong. I went to college. I had it all. And then I was broken down, you know. So here I am, opening myself up, being vulnerable to this new environment. The teachers, they ask, how much TV are your children watching a week? They ask, you know, they help me with routine. What time are your children going to bed at night? Because we noticed they were a little crabby at school today. I'm like, how did they know that my child went to bed late? They knew. They paid attention to details, community. So they talked to the parents, and they did things like potlucks and parent coffee. So you knew who your children were with. You trusted them. And not to mention, I didn't have a child biting my children while I was gone. I could drop my children off and not worry about where they, you know, what would happen to them. because I was clearly against having my child anywhere besides with me. But I knew I needed, because I didn't have support. I didn't have any type of support at all. Not my mother, not my father, nobody. So it's just me and my children. And it was driving me crazy. So, you know, I just can't say enough about how Montessori's helped my children. And when the other parent talked about second language, well, in those classrooms, there's guide and there's assistants, where the assistants speak only Spanish to my children. So I thought that was amazing. And the articulance of speech that my children developed as a result of going there, just things like, instead of duck, oh, Mom, that's a Canada goose. Like, what? Yeah, and my 4-year-old son, at the time he was 4, he's 7 now. They, you know, somebody at my church said, "Bet you don't know what kind of bird that is." He said, "Oh yeah, that's a cardinal." Like, wow. So I am a big supporter of parent choice, as well as early childhood scholarships.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I'm sorry, your last name is it Weber?
Weber.
Okay.
Two B's.
Okay, very good. Just want to make sure we get that for the record. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you for having us today. Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Marnie McPherson, and I am the head of school at White Bear Montessori School. We are a private nonprofit organization. We are AMI recognized. We are 4-star parent aware rated. And we, in September of this coming September, will be celebrating our 45th year serving the White Bear community families. So we're very excited and proud to celebrate that. Although we serve children from through the sixth grade, 75% of our population is between the ages of 16 months old and 6 years old. So we are primarily preschool-aged facility. We have 5 teaching staff that are highly qualified. They all have 4-year degrees. Some have master's. One has 3. But they all have the minimum master's training required to teach at an AMI Montessori school. All of my staff, meaning non-teaching staff and faculty staff, either double or triple every year the required hours of staff development set forth by DHS. So it's a high-quality institution. Part of our mission is bringing high-quality Montessori education, embracing all cultures and socioeconomical backgrounds. Like Renee said from Sunny Hollow, we could just accept families that could pay our full tuition. But why I'm here today was we have a very unique story in our community. We've seen a huge change in our demographic in the last 7 years. Just to give you an example, in 2008, we had 95 preschool-aged children across 4 classrooms. Since then, we have closed 1 preschool room, and this fall, we will be closing yet another. We will have 56 preschool-aged children, which will occupy 2 classrooms. Doing so will displace one of my highly trained master's level teachers who would much rather stay and teach children and families who want high quality education. At the same time of this downward decreasing enrollment, the demand for scholarship funds has increased in the same amount of years by 7 times. 7 times. We're a small nonprofit school with families that come to us all the time, who come into our classrooms and, just like Octavia said, fall in love with the quality of the environment, the quality of the staff, the quality of our expectations for routine and food and just the whole child development. And we're doing the best we can to serve that community. The school is awarding roughly $80,000 in tuition assistance next fall, and that's not including the families that are getting county assistance or the Pathways Scholarship. But even that is not enough to meet the demand that we're seeing in our community. We'll be losing 4 families this fall because we can't make their financial aid requirements. So we're here to request that parents are continually able to access these funds. There's a huge need. There's a changing community. It's not just the low-income families anymore. It's the low-income middle-class families anymore. I have a community that is shrinking, and we would love to fill our doors, but we are desperately need the funding. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Hi there. My name is Shauna Marianovich, and I co-founded the Minnesota Montessori Network, and we are a member of the Mini Minds Advisory Council as well. I'd like to close some of our testimony here. We do have a room full of teachers who could amaze you with the stories of the scholarship children that they have served, very similar to Octavia's children. But I'd like to close with something a little different. I'd like to remind us that the solution in Minnesota is already here. You guys are here providing the funding that is going to be needed to serve our earliest learners and our highest risk learners. You've done the big business, and leave it to the fun of government and maybe human politics to find an argument and find a debate where really maybe there isn't one. So is universal pre-K or school readiness or scholarships really some miles and miles of divide? I'm not really sure we've heard that today. I think we've heard that serving our most at-risk children and serving them with parental choice already works in our state in an amazing way. In our Montessori community, with those 16,000 families, we have the opportunity to serve in almost every one of your districts. We serve them through every single delivery method available. We have 1/3 of our children in public schools. And many of those, the vast majority, are receiving the scholarship funds you already offer. So are we really debating something, or do we already have the solution? You just need to provide the funding you've already agreed to provide, this massive amount of funding. You just need to direct it where we already have the vehicles and already have the partnerships. If I can be frank, we have figured it out, and we don't need your help on that front. Honestly, the partnerships are there. We are working in amazing ways in these public schools. Your funding, targeting school readiness with very restrictive pieces for parents, that doesn't exactly acknowledge those beautiful partnerships we've already made. In fact, it creates adversaries in our community that don't need to exist. We are not fighting today. Please don't prompt us to fight over 4-year-olds when we're all trying to serve the exact same needs around that table and this room. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. And I want to thank all of our testifiers today. You've done a great job of providing some very passionate and instructive testimony, and a lot for us to think about. So, and also on our earlier topic way back when we started on extended support revenue as well. So with that, Senator Wigger, did you want to make any announcements about the next meeting?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'd also like to echo your compliments to the testifiers. Well done. For the next meeting, we have the gavel for tomorrow. We don't plan on meeting unless there is some breaking news on targets. I don't expect that. And we've talked. You have the gavel Saturday.
Yes, and I do not plan to call us in on Saturday unless there would be some breaking news on targets as well.
So are you disappointed?
Okay. But well, check your emails in case something happens.
So, the announcement would be to stay tuned. That we have had a great deal of information presented. We'll be processing that. Staff will continue looking at the same and similar language, looking at how we will adopt that once we get targets. But we'll stay tuned and thank everyone for their participation and thoughtful attention.
So the next plan would be probably Monday?
Yeah, probably our next meeting would be Monday.
So if they don't catch fish on Saturday, do you expect targets?
I have no idea. All right, so with that, the conference committee is adjourned for today.
Good meeting.
Thank you, yes.